This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, comic Louie Anderson, co-stars in the new FX comedy series Baskets, playing the mother of Zach Galifianakis' character. Even though he's long been considered a family-friendly comic, his comedy comes from a very dark place. He grew up in a housing project in St. Paul, Minnesota, with an alcoholic father and 10 siblings. He considers food his drug, and he's been told many times by doctors he has to lose weight. He came very close to shooting himself in the head some years ago before he was supposed to go on stage. We'll hear about that a little later. Terry spoke with Anderson last Wednesday, and they began with two short scenes from Baskets. His character, Christine Baskets, is the mother of Chip Baskets, an aspiring clown who's always been a loser and is a bitter, angry guy. Christine can be very critical of Chip, but she can also be his biggest supporter. Chip didn't tell his mother that he got married to a French woman, and when the mother finds out, she invites her new daughter-in-law on a trip to one of Christine's favorite places, Costco.
Oh, look at this.
Oh, that's perfect for you.
Oh.
I'm going to get one, too. Oh, I love this place. I'd love to get lost in here. Wouldn't it be something? Do you have this in France?
Not yet.
I didn't think so. Oh, acid reducer. This stuff is a lifesaver. Do you have multi-packs in France?
I don't think we take so much medication in France like you do.
Oh, well, that's a shame. Oh, cheese balls. It's the only thing Chip would eat as a child. I got tired of fighting him on it. I gave him to him for breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Nice dietary kid, huh?
Oh, he blew up, but I helped him get the weight off. I always supported Chip. He needed more attention than other kids. But I always supported him, even during this clowning phase. It's hard being a good mother. I mean, $1.50 for a quarter-pound hot dog and a drink. Très bien, right?
Later, Christine discovers that the daughter-in-law married her son Chip only to get a green card. Here's Christine, played by Louie Anderson, driving Penelope back to her apartment after dinner.
Well then, thank you so much for buying dinner.
It's nothing. Thank you very much for the tour of Bakerfield.
A sure thing. Well, I'll wait here. You get your stuff.
What stuff?
All your stuff. We're going to head to the airport. I have a direct flight to Paris for you. I got it on Iceland Air. I got a very good deal. Of course, all my miles are in Southwest, but oh, you can't pass up a bargain.
What are you talking about, Mama Basket?
Well, I had a conversation with your father, Monsieur Hubert. I guess I wasn't the only one in the dark on the marriage. He said for me to tell you this. If you're not on that flight, you can kiss your trust fund goodbye. Those were his words. He spoke very good English.
I'm sorry.
I'm not as simple as you think I am, dear. Here you go. There now. Take your time, then get your things.
Louie Anderson, welcome to Fresh Air and congratulations on your performance in Baskets. Now, Zach Galifianakis told us that when he was casting the part of the mother, the part that you play, he heard a voice in his head, and he did that voice for Louis C.K., who produces Baskets. And Louis C.K. said, oh, you mean like Louie Anderson's voice? So they decided, well, why not call Louie Anderson? So they called you. Did you have any reservations about whether you could convincingly play a woman?
No, unfortunately, I did not. I grew up with a really great, strong woman in my mother of 11 children and 5 wonderful sisters. And so I didn't have any. And I've been doing my mom's act, her voice, to some degree in my act for, you know, several years.
What's the difference between your voice and your mom's voice?
Well, my voice is, you know, the voice I'm speaking to you in, and my mom's voice is, Terry Gross, huh? Now, What is that? Is that Irish? Gross. Terry, I've always liked that name. My mom was never without a compliment.
Whether she meant it or not.
I think she meant it. She loved people, and she loved conversation, and she loved to engage with people. She was a really fantastic person. You would have really liked her.
What other qualities did you take from your mother to give to your character of the mother in Baskets?
Well, she was a little passive-aggressive, you know, like in that those scenes you played. Isn't this something? You don't have this in France. You know, that little side. She just could slide stuff in and you go, did I just get cut by a really sharp razor? Mom, what did you... You know, she just had that... She had that thing. She was a little competitive, but she loved to show off. She was a show-off. I really love playing this part for a big reason that my mom gets to come to life. It's the weirdest thing when you get a wig, when that wig and the makeup comes on. You know, I work on the transformation, I think, while I'm getting dressed.
Yeah, what about the dresses? You wear these, like, big dresses with large, bold, primary color patterns, you know, caftans, long necklaces, an Easter bonnet in one scene. How do wearing those clothes help you get into character, and who do those clothes remind you of?
Well, the first day that I went in to see the clothes, it was early on. We were all going to meet and do a group photo, I think it was. And there was a big wall of clothes. And I just went through it. And I go, this would be good. This would be good. And I just thought of my mom and my sisters. I said, this will be good. I said, that's out. Nothing like that. They have to be really colorful. Make them enter the room sometimes before the I will, you know, make them what a person who hasn't got a lot of money thinks is really fancy. Make it real American, right? Make her a big American woman. And I have to tell you, it was kind of, even though I never dressed up in my mom's clothes or never had any real desire to put it on, I always remember how soft her clothes were. You know, my mom always had soft, like a lot of jersey knits. And my mom was ahead of her time. She wore pantsuits. And she goes, you know what I like about a pantsuit, Louie? And I go, what, Mom? Oh, I just look so good in it.
Was she a plus-sized woman?
She was. She was a big girl.
You talk about her eating. There's a scene after she's kind of spurned by her adopted twins. She takes to her room with a tub of ice cream and a big scoop and is eating it, lying on her side, eating it from the scoop.
And now, that would have never been my mom. I've done that. I'm a food addict. You know, I go to OA and I really work hard on trying to eat better, especially lately. I've been really working hard on it. And so I know what that's like. When you're really down, if you're any kind of an addicted person, you are not eating for flavor, and you're not eating for, you're eating for some comfort that can never come from what you're doing. There's no comfort that can actually come from it, but there is a familiarity that I think comes with it. So it was really a sad scene, but I really think that the scene was really important to show her disappointment. With, you know, when you go out on a limb and pretty much put those kids above everybody else in the family, and then they just kind of blow you off, it's a big blow to her.
Mm-hmm. Did you and your mother bond over eating together?
Well, my dad was an alcoholic, and he was a really mean and, you know, could be very vicious. And so with anybody who's grown up with an alcoholic knows that there's usually a fight to bring everything to a head in an alcoholic family where, you know, the lines are drawn and that either ends with police coming or, in our case, my mom would feed us. It was the weirdest thing. So there's a lot of stuff emotionally tied to my eating. And then I created a character on stage that had a lot to do with being fat. And so I really boxed myself in a lot, and I'm really aware of it.
You think that you boxed yourself in. Were you referring to your persona as a heavy person?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I would, and I would never play those parts in movies, so I was kind of limited. And I wasn't a very good actor early on. I was a terrible actor because I didn't know who I was or how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But I feel like this part gave me an opportunity to play the most real person, a really real person. That's what I was really going for here, Terry. I was really going for a really real person. I don't know if that even makes any sense.
No, it does. That's what I love about your portrayal. It's like, it's funny, but it's also sad because she's sad a lot of the time and feels, you know, rejected and lonely. But it's never like pathos.
I think a lot of women are sad.
Well, I think a lot of everybody's sad.
Yeah. But I mean, yes, I agree that a lot of everybody is sad. But, you know, this whole thing about raising all the kids, you know, so much. I remember my dad would work and my mom raised the kids. And it was a weird, like, it was very lopsided in one sense. You know, and I figured that out early on, you know. Because I think my mom, all she did was wash clothes and put them in the dryer and then fed us and then, you know, wash clothes and put them in the, you know, it was just very.
Yeah, 11 kids. So,
you know,
I was very sorry to hear about your brother, Tommy, who died last week in his sleep. And this was like your youngest sibling. You had been the youngest of 10. Then yeah. He was born. He was the
youngest. I was youngest at 10. And then he was. Ugh.
It sounds like his death was totally unexpected. You've described him as your inspiration. In what sense was he that?
Well, you know, like he was my, you know, such a good friend. And, you know, he was really smart. He was the kind of guy I could call up and go, what do you think? He go, that's all crap. That's all bull. Don't do that. That's no good. You know, like he was just that kind of guy. He had a thing we called the Truth Ranger where he goes, everybody should tell the truth as long as it doesn't hurt anyone's feelings. And I just laughed. I go, Tommy, you're so sweet. Of course, it's going to hurt people's feelings if you always tell them the truth. Well, you know, you just don't know how to tell them the truth then, Louis. And I go, maybe not. But it broke my heart. My heart's completely broken right now.
When you did comedy about him,
I used to tell him he was adopted. Him. I said, you were adopted. And I used to say they were frog-faced people. Pretty soon your eyes are going to pop out. Your eyes are going to pop out.
How old were you when you stopped tormenting him?
Just before he died. He'd like that. I think there was always a little bit of a, like, Tommy used to get really mad at me if I interrupted him. Tommy was a very, really precise person. So, and he suffered from, you know, some bipolar stuff and those kind of things and a little bit of paranoia. And he didn't have an easy life. He had a tough life. And he lived on the streets for many years. And finally, I always would take care of him if I could. And finally, I said, Tommy, I'm not going to, you got to get it together. I'm not going to help you anymore. You're just being unreasonable. And that was with some advice from a good friend, because I was at my wit's end. My good friend said, listen, he's got to hit bottom and then you'll be able to deal with it. And it was really good. It was good advice because he did. And he said, Louis, I need your help. He said, when he asks for your help, then you'll be of use. He said, Louis, I need your help. And I said, Tommy, you know what you should do, Tommy? Your sisters could really use your help. I think you should move back home and take care of your sisters. I think they could really use your help. And so like 5 or 6 years ago, he moved back to Minnesota and he really did. He took care of my sister, one sister till she passed away, and my other sisters. And he really helped. And we had a service for him Sunday and people talked about how much that he had done for them. And it was really, I was really touched by how many people loved Tommy. I thought I was the only one who loved him that much. But of course, my whole family loved him. And we're going to miss him.
Does having a younger brother who died, and you're around 63, he was 60, has that made you think a lot about your own mortality?
You know, it's so funny, like mortality. The first time I really felt anything about mortality was in 1990 when my mom died. That's where I really went, oh my God, I think I could die now. It was, you know, very devastating. When I lost my dad, you know, my dad was a really bad drunk, but a really funny guy, and he stuck with us and he stayed. My mom, I'll never forget, my dad quit drinking when he was 69. And here was my mom's response. She turned to me and she said, I told you he'd quit drinking. and I just said that, you know, and that's who the character Christine is, don't you think? Don't you think that in a nutshell, that's Christine?
Mm-hmm, sure.
Finding a silver lining in, you know, it was very profound. I didn't even realize it when she said it.
Let's talk about something that's happened to you or that you did nearly to yourself and how that either could or could not become something that you'd use on stage. You tell a story in one of your books about how you were in your dressing room backstage before a performance. You had a gun. You put it to your head and you were very serious about pulling the trigger. You thought first about something you'd seen on TV in which an expert explained that if you shoot yourself in the wrong part of your head, you might survive and then just be brain damaged, which would be worst case scenario. So you tried to do it, you know, place it in the right spot. And then you thought, oh, I don't want to leave a mess. So you got a towel. And then you decided not to pull the trigger and you went on stage and it went really well. The audience liked it. You felt better about being alive after that. So, okay, so that's a kind of near suicide story. Has that made it on stage into one of your performances?
No, but here's what I'll say to you. I never even thought of it as a thing. But, you know, I could do it. You're exactly right. I could do it in a second. It would be funny. That whole experience was I didn't want anyone to find me. That really was the thing is, I didn't want that to be their last memory of me.
Right. Either be that.
You know, that was another big part of it, you know. So you're right. That could be, I mean, you know, I did a dark joke for a while ago. I was going to kill myself, but I just thought I would just eat myself to death. But nobody ever laughed, Terry. I couldn't get people to laugh because it was too dark, don't you think?
What do I know?
No, I'm gonna turn the tables on you.
Okay.
Will you allow me?
Yes.
Okay. Terry.
Yes.
What is it? Are you doing exactly, always have you done? Has your road been this road that you're on?
I've been doing shows like this like my whole adult life.
And this is what you've always wanted. You've never wanted to get on a show where you just let it fly and just go. Rrr, 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 rrr.
It would be really out of character to do that.
It would be. So do people think, because, you know, you're not the first person to be mentioning this stuff to me. So do people think I'm a wimp? And I don't mean that in a mean way. But do people think I'm too sweet? I'm too nice? There's a dark thing that should be explored and that I should lay it all out there?
I don't know what people think. I think that there's...
Well, you brought it up.
Yeah, though. I think you that there's up. Maybe an edge in your humor that you're protecting your audience from.
Don't you think they see it, Terry?
Probably. It's probably true.
You know, like, don't you think they probably think he has a knife, but I don't necessarily want to see it?
Yeah, I get that. Yeah.
Do you think that, I mean...
That's interesting way to put it. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Let me reintroduce you. If you're just joining us, my guest is comic Louis Anderson, who co-stars in the new FX series Baskets as Zach Galifianakis's mother. What was the comedy scene like when you were just getting started? And where did you see
Fantastic.
Yourself fitting in? Like, how did you find your place within it?
Well, I mean, there are two comedy scenes, one in Minneapolis where I started.
Mm-hmm.
So there were only like a handful of us. So we'd do the show. And you could do as much time as you want because we only had 6-7 people. So it was like an hour and a half show. Nobody had too much material, you know. And then we were smart. We had a little club and whenever anyone famous was in town, we had invited them down. Joan Rivers, Henny Youngman, Rodney Dangerfield. And that's where I became friends with Joan and Rodney. They both told me I should go to East or West Coast and become... successful. They were both very nice, and I stayed friends with both of them until their deaths. But I was on stage one night, and I was doing jokes, and I go, "Is that your dad?" to a kid sitting with a guy. He goes, "Yeah." I go, "He seems like a nice dad. You guys get along?" He goes, "Yeah." And then that was the first time I did. Yeah, my dad never hit us either, but he carried a gun. And then I did that joke. Never shot us. He'd just go, you know. And that got the biggest laugh of anything I had ever done. And it got a different kind of laugh. Like a, oh. And it opened something up in me.
Mm-hmm.
And I started mining my family stuff right then. I just started digging. And then I came off stage, and a guy named Roman Decaire, God rest his soul, he was a Shriner, and he played a little harmonica, and he was told really silly jokes. He'd hit a bad note on the little tiny harmonica, and then he'd pull out of his hand a rubber pickle. He'd go, "Ooh, that's a sour note." And then he'd do these really dumb, but we loved him. He was a very sweet guy. And I came off stage, and he said, "Louis," just talk like this, "Louis, if you did that material about your family and you had a completely clean act, you'll become famous." And, you know, I was listening to him and I just said, "Really?" You know, I was looking for somebody to tell me something. I didn't know. I just wanted to, you know, be successful. And then in 1981, I moved out to Los Angeles, and for 2 years, I auditioned for The Tonight Show and finally got it. And, you know, with Howie and Robin and
this is in
Roseanne
the Johnny Carson era.
Yeah, this is the big time. This is the HBO babies, you know, in comedy. All those guys, we all did specials, you know. And that's what kind of, you know, I wasn't like anyone else. And I never felt competitive. When I first became really successful, I did The Tonight Show, and I had a big Tonight Show in terms of, you know, Johnny's response, you know. And the Comedy Store had a party for me, and I was really I was in heaven, and I was really full of myself. It was really funny. It was, you know, I can even look back at it and laugh. And I was saying, "Hey, I am the greatest in the whole thing," and all that stuff. And a guy come up to me, he goes, "Are you Louis Anderson?" I go, "I am." And I put my hand out to meet him, and he goes, "I don't want to meet you. Could you move your car?" And it happened twice to me that night. My karma was so immediate.
Louis Anderson, I want to thank you so much for coming
thank
on
you.
The show. Congratulations on your performance in Baskets. And my sympathies. I'm so sorry about your brother, Tom.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm going to send you about 50 of his flashlights that we found. We found, honestly, over 100 flashlights.
Oh, gosh.
Just in one little area. And I go, what was he?
Was he a hoarder?
You know what I always say about my family? We were pack rats. We weren't hoarders because we have aisles.
Comic Louis Anderson spoke with Terry last Wednesday. Anderson co-stars on the FX series Baskets. The Waco Brothers have been around for 20 years now, a mostly Chicago-based band whose most prominent member is the British expatriate John Langford. The five-piece band has just released Going Down in History, the Waco Brothers' first album of original material in a decade. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
This is the first track from the last album. No one knows which way the ship will head. Sailors take warning, red eyes in the morning. You can't kill us, we're already dead. As the country seeks executive.
The Waco Brothers are a rock band with a strong country music influence and a punk rock ethos. The result is rough edge music that sounds as though it's been bashed out in a couple of takes with minimal rehearsal. Instead of seeming sloppy or lazy, however, the music on Going Down in History is urgent, precise, and pointed.
It's all gone. We used up everything. Gotta find something. Gotta walk before you can fall down on your face.
A recurring phrase in that song is, commit to something drastic. The idea being that extremism in the defense of music is a most admirable goal. John Langford is also one of the leaders of the Mekons, one of the most ferociously political of the original wave of punk rock bands. All of the band members sing, but it's Langford's burly shout that is most distinctively recognizable. The literal centerpiece of this album, arriving midway through, is All or Nothing, a song written by Ian McLagan, the British keyboardist and best known as a member of The Faces, who died in 2014. He was a friend of the Wacos, and they give his composition a proper showcase, lifting it into the realm of an anthem of commitment to art and work and love. I thought you'd listen to my When the Waco Brothers started out, they were almost a parody of a country rock band placed within the context of ironic punk thinking. The band also possesses that Chicago style of deep-dish, tough-minded aesthetic analysis. And as Langford in particular dug deeper into the history of American country music, he began to realize the depth of beauty and truth in the best of the genre. With each succeeding album, the Waco Brothers have become less ironic, more sincere, and forthright in speaking truth to country rock as a still vital form. Going Down in History is the best attempt yet for the band to do what that album title says.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. He reviewed Going Down in History by the Waco Brothers. What would you do if you found out that one of your childhood heroes was a racist? When writer Victor Laval was growing up in Queens, he loved reading the horror stories of H.P. Lovecraft. It was only when he got older that Laval recognized the racism in Lovecraft's fiction, poetry, and letters, which particularly stung because Laval is black. Laval's new novella is both a tribute to and a criticism of H.P. Lovecraft. Its dedication reads, "For H.P. Lovecraft, with all my conflicted feelings." H.P. Lovecraft wrote stories for pulp magazines in the early 20th century, but was largely unsuccessful and died young and poor, achieving fame posthumously. His most lasting creation was his creature Cthulhu, a mountain-sized entity with an octopus for its head. One of Lovecraft's most xenophobic stories, The Horror at Red Rock, is the jumping-off point for Laval's new book, The Ballad of Black Tom. It takes place in 1924 and follows the story of a young black man from Harlem named Tommy Tester as he negotiates racism, police brutality, and cosmic terror. Laval's other books include The Devil in Silver and Big Machine. He spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger last Monday, and they began with a reading from the beginning of Laval's new book.
People who move to New York always make the same mistake. They can't see the place. This is true of Manhattan, but even the outer boroughs, too, be it Flushing Meadows in Queens or Red Hook in Brooklyn. They come looking for magic, whether evil or good, and nothing will convince them it isn't here. This wasn't all bad, though. Some New Yorkers had learned how to make a living from this error in thinking. Charles Thomas Tester, for one. The morning of most importance began with a trip from Charles's apartment in Harlem. He'd been hired to make a delivery to a house out in Queens. He shared the crib in Harlem with his ailing father, Otis, a man who'd been dying ever since his wife of 21 years expired. They'd had one child, Charles Thomas, and even though he was 20 and exactly the age for independence, he played the role of dutiful son. Charles worked to support his dying dad. He hustled to provide food and shelter and a little extra to lay on a number from time to time. God knows he didn't make any more than that. A little after 8 a.m., he left the apartment in his gray flannel suit. The slacks were cuffed but scuffed, and the sleeves conspicuously short. Fine fabric but frayed. This gave Charles a certain look, like a gentleman without a gentleman's bank account. He picked the brown leather brogues with nicked toes, then the seal brown trooper hat instead of the fedora. The trooper hat's brim showed its age and wear, and this was good for his hustle, too. Last, he took the guitar case, essential to complete the look. He left the guitar itself at home with his bedridden father. Inside, he carried only a yellow book, not much larger than a pack of cards. In the apartment, Charles Thomas Tester went by Charles, but on the street, everyone knew him as Tommy. Tommy Tester, always carrying a guitar case. This wasn't because he aspired to be a musician. In fact, he could barely remember a handful of songs, and his singing voice might be described kindly as wobbly. His father, who'd made a living as a bricklayer, and his mother, who'd spent her life working as a domestic, had loved music. Dad played guitar, and mother could really stroll on a piano. It was only natural that Tommy Tester ended up drawn to performing, the only tragedy being that he lacked talent. He thought of himself as an entertainer. There were others who would have called him a scammer, a swindler, a con, but he never thought of himself that way. No good charlatan ever did.
And that's Victor Laval reading from his new book, The Ballad of Black Tom. Victor Laval, welcome back to Fresh Air.
It's good to be back. Thanks.
So your new book is both a tribute to and a criticism of the early 20th century horror writer H.P. Lovecraft. Before we get to the criticism, how influential was he to you growing up? Did you read him a lot as a kid?
He was one of the four foundational writers, probably, of my youth. I think I picked him up at about the age of 10 or 11, and I would say it was him, Stephen King, Shirley Jackson, and Clive Barker were these four writers, all horror writers, who meant the world to me. And Lovecraft stood out in a way because he was the most, he was the oldest of all of them. He had written the earliest, but also he was the strangest.
So you said that as a child, these stories were powerful to you because they sort of somehow connected to your feelings of what it was like to be a child.
Well, I think, 10 or 11 years old, I'm living with my mom and my grandmother. I've got my uncle who comes by all the time. They all tell me what to do. I have my teachers who tell me what to do. I'm not quite old enough yet to be truly independent. And yet, I think I'm the smartest person in all of Queens by 10 or 11. So how could these people have power over me? There must be some cosmic evil at play, you know? There must be something that explains why I feel so powerless. And Lovecraft, in his own life, felt incredibly powerless. He was from a family that once had wealth but had lost it all. He was raised in a very cloying family atmosphere, and then his mother died, his father was institutionalized, and then he was essentially left alone, left to his own devices. And so in many ways, even though he's this incredibly smart and well-read human being, he was also this, in many ways, this flailing 10 or 11-year-old kid. And the compliment that you can pay to his art is that he actually got that down on a page in a way that this 10 or 11-year-old black kid from Queens could also relate to.
Okay, let's talk about the part that you can't relate to. It seems that H.P. Lovecraft, you know, from his fiction, his poetry, his letters, that he was racist. When did you realize that first?
Well, here's the funny thing. So I didn't realize it when I was 10 or 11 reading these stories, and I read pretty much all of them. And in some of them, he's pretty blatant about his particular hatred, particularly of black people. When I was 10 or 11 and I read these stories, I read them only for the wild and outlandish plots and the large cosmic dread sort of thing. And in a way, I was naive, and I could overlook what should have been blatant clues about the uglier sides of H.P. Lovecraft's personality and his ideas. Like, for instance, the story where he has a cat named Nigger Man, and he calls him that 19 times in this really short story, and takes great pleasure in talking about kicking this cat and all this stuff. And then he has other things. He has a poem that's pretty famous. He has a longer story, The Case of Charles Dexter Ward, that gets into some ugly stuff. And somehow when I was like 10 or 11, I just didn't even see it. I think I just couldn't have processed it. And then when I started being about 15 or 16, I started being like, what is this dude? What did he just say? And it was the kind of thing that you would say, like, if you were walking down the street and somebody said that, you'd smack him in the mouth. So why did I say that it was okay on the page? And yet, by this point, I already loved the stories. So it made for these very conflicted feelings.
So this new book, The Ballad of Black Tom, is a response to Lovecraft. And the jumping off point, one of his most notoriously xenophobic stories, it's called The Horror of Red Hook. And Red Hook is a neighborhood in Brooklyn. Red Hook at the time, I think, was the most of the people living there were recent immigrants, it seems like. What were some of the things that he said about the people that lived there in that story?
Well, in the story, he calls them like the dregs of humanity. He calls them a reckless cauldron of chaos. I can't remember the exact phrases, but I think one example that will give you an idea of how he felt about being in Red Hook, and at Red Hook was full of lots of different immigrants from all around the world. And one thing I remember reading that gave me an idea of who Lovecraft was and sort of what made its way into his work and into that story is that when they were walking down the street, he and his wife, if a group of immigrants was walking on the sidewalk, he would walk into the middle of the road.
Wow.
Just so that he could avoid being near them.
The way he's describing people in Red Hook, I mean, it sounds obsessive. It sounds maybe slightly pathological. But it's also really interesting that it sounds like the way he described the monsters of his writing.
I would say that what Lovecraft was getting down on the page a great deal was his fear of everything. Everything. He feared women. He feared anyone who wasn't white. He feared Jewish people. I wouldn't be surprised if he feared, like, cars as well. He was just so afraid of the modern world. And he managed to, rather than making it a one-for-one and just having those groups of people who he feared and hated show up in the books and stories as people acting terribly, he came up with these strange and impossible creatures, because really on some level he was almost trying to capture the depth and breadth of his terror.
So your main character, Tommy Tester, is a young man. You describe him, I think, as a hustler. He's dedicated to providing for a sick father. And he carries around this guitar with him all the time, even though he's not a very good musician. In fact, you say that he's kicked out of a rent party by no one other than Willie the Lion Smith because he was so bad. Why do you have him carrying around this guitar, even though he's not very good on it?
Well, his hustle is basically that he tries to trick people into thinking he's a good blues musician or jazz musician because he looks the part, right? He's got on the right clothes. They're a little bit frayed, but there's a certain elegance there. He carries around the case, and he's black. And so you just take those elements and you put them together, and a certain kind of person says, I wonder if that's a blues man. Essentially, they buy into the illusion, and that's what he is. He's an illusionist, you know? And in this case in particular, I make the point that he has to leave Harlem in order for his hustle to work, because no one in Harlem is going to think it's all that special to see a black man dressed in a suit playing a guitar. They're actually going to expect him to be good at it, because there's lots of musicians there, lots of folks on the street busking, and so they can tell the difference between the two, good and bad. But when he goes out into Brooklyn and he goes on to these white neighborhoods in particular, there it's more like they're just looking for someone to fill a certain idea that they have of what a jazz man is or a blues man is. And that is what Tommy Tester can do. He can live up to that idea, and as a result of living up to that idea, hustle a little money out of that person for his performance or just for his presence.
Why do you decide to make him a hustler?
Well, you know, on one level, what I was sort of thinking about was the hustle of writing as a whole, right? And specifically the hustle of being a black writer, that time and again, and this is If you're a Southern writer, if you're a Midwestern writer, if you're a woman writer, if you're a Jewish writer, there's all these hustles that if you play into them, there are already readers, there are already accolades, there are already avenues that have been set up to essentially decide that you are good at that because you essentially just look like someone who should be good at that, right? It's the idea that if you look the part, we'll overlook your mediocrity. That's something that is always on my mind as a Black writer. I mean, there are certain avenues that I think you could approach them in ways that have been done by geniuses before. And because it sort of looks like what a genius of a previous generation did, you may enjoy the glow of that genius, that secondary light. You can be a moon to their sun. And you can make a whole career off of essentially being that. And I was terrified at the idea of turning into someone like that. And so I wanted to funnel that into the book as, like, on some level, that's what Tommy's doing. But, of course, I didn't want to make him a writer who is dealing with exactly that issue because, at least for me, few things are less interesting than a writer dealing with what kind of writer they're going to be.
Did you feel in your career at points that you were writing in a way that was like that sort of secondhand version of greatness that someone else had already done?
Well, you know, I'll tell you something that happened that was very interesting. So I put out my first book was a book of short stories that I was very proud of. It was 12 short stories. It's called Slapboxing with Jesus. And the general description might be gritty stories about Black and Latino boys growing up in New York City, mm-hmm. right? And the fact that I could even sum it up that way might tell you some degree of, like, what the book is like. Mm-hmm. And then years passed. I put the book out. It enjoyed whatever readership and success it enjoyed. It did good things for me in life. And then, you know, I joined Facebook however many years later, and I was in touch with a couple of the guys who I grew up with. And they said to me, well, we saw that you wrote a book, and we're going to look it up. We want to be real proud of you and all this. And so they bought the books, two or three of them in particular. And then one of them was in touch with me later, and he said, I read the book, yeah, and I loved it. I thought you did a great job and all that stuff. He said, but, you know, something I do want to point out to you is that we were happy sometimes, you know? We didn't always just do terrible things, and terrible things weren't only done to us. And if he had said it to me maybe right when the book came out, I think I would have been too raw and defensive, you know? But with some years' distance, I realized that on some level what he was saying was, if all you do is wallow in this kind of urban misery, it turns into a kind of like urban misery porn that can do quite well. If you write well, and you write Black misery with some literary flair, there is an avenue for that. And there are writers from earlier generations who did that with true genius and were bringing news to the world. But I felt like what my friend was saying was, you didn't bring all the news from our time. You just brought the news that in some way you knew people wanted to hear. And that's not the job of an artist.
Your main character, Tommy Tester, is an amateurish guitar player, and he gets this gig to play at a white man's party in a house in Brooklyn for an incredible amount of money, and he tells his dad about it. His father's scared because this sounds so impossible, and he's worried for his son's life. So he gives him two things. He gives him a razor blade and a song, which he calls conjure music, and the song that he teaches Tommy is called Grinning in Your Face by Sun House. Do you want to sing us a little bit of that?
Okay, I'll try.
Okay.
Don't you mind someone grinning in your face? Don't you mind someone grinning in your face? Oh, bear this in mind, a true friend is hard to find. Don't mind people grinning in your face.
That was
I learned
great.
On the last one that it was people, not someone.
Oh, really?
So it took a minute. Yeah. I don't think I have another version of it, though,
dying.
In me.
No, that was good. So why'd you choose that song? I mean, you're imbuing the song with with magical qualities.
Well, I'm doing that, number one, because Sun House is just one of the greatest blues musicians ever. But the other part of it was just the basic idea in there that Tommy is this hustler who thinks he always knows how to fool people. He always knows how to play people. But he himself also gets pulled into a game. He also gets fooled by this white guy who gets him to come to his mansion and play this song, because things go, it turns out he's got much bigger plans for Tommy, and much more nefarious ideas are afoot. And so I wanted it to be that his father gave him a straight razor to protect himself, but the song, and the specifically like the actual lyrics of the song, were another way that he was trying to get his son to see that he should not trust this man he was going to.
So when's your blue CD coming out?
I'm going to make it a BitTorrent that people can download, and I'll do a little backwards tracking in there, so there's something ugly and some secret messages in there.
That sounds good. Well, Victor Laval, thanks so much for being here.
Hey, Sam, it was a pleasure.
Victor Laval spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger. Laval's new novella is called The Ballad of Black Tom.
Don't you mind people grinning in your face?
Fresh Air Weekend is produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Thea Challoner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Oh, baby.